So I want to start today with a number that on paper it just looks boring, almost like a typo.
It doesn't exactly grab you, does it?
No, not at all. 1.5%. I mean, if my investment portfolio grew 1.5% a year, I'd be looking for a new financial advisor.
You probably would. But the sources we're diving into today argue that this number is, well, it's basically a modern miracle.
A miracle? Okay, explain that.
It's the steady heartbeat of the US economy for almost 200 years now. Since the early 1800s, GDP per capita in the United States has grown at this relentless, steady 1.5% a year.
Which feels so slow. But I guess the power is in the compounding.
Exactly. It's the old rule of 72. At 1.5%, your standard of living doubles about every 47
So
years.
every couple of generations, the average person is twice as wealthy.
Precisely. And over two centuries, I mean, you go from horse-drawn carriages to MRI machines. That's the power of that seemingly boring number.
What's really wild to me is the consistency. You look at the chart, and it covers the Civil War, the Great Depression, two world wars.
The 2008 crash, the dot-com bubble.
And they're just little blips on the line. The trend just keeps marching up. It's almost unnatural.
It really suggests that the underlying engine of growth is incredibly robust. But, and this is really the core of what we're talking about today, that engine is not firing everywhere.
Right. And that gets us to the trillion-dollar question, as our sources call it. If this recipe for wealth exists, why are some countries so rich and others so poor?
The gap is, it's honestly hard to wrap your head around. We aren't talking about small differences.
We're not talking BMW versus Honda here.
No, we're talking about the United States versus, say, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. In 2019, the income difference was a factor of 64.
Wow. Let's just sit with that for a second. A factor of 64.
It means the average worker in the Congo has to work for over 60 years, a lifetime, to earn what the average US worker makes in a single year.
That's not an economic gap. That's a different planet.
It is. The Nobel laureate Robert Lucas famously said that once you start thinking about what these numbers mean for human welfare, it is hard to think about anything else.
I can see why. It makes other problems seem small in comparison. So, for this deep dive, our mission is to unpack that. Is it luck? Is it geography? Or is it something we can actually understand and fix?
To start, you have to look at the data, and the source material uses the US as a kind of benchmark. It sets the US to one to measure everyone else against it.
As the frontier of what's possible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And when you do that, you see three really different stories play out over the last, say, 60 years or so.
Okay, let's break those down. Who's winning this race?
The clearest winner is East Asia, the
Ooh.
growth miracle, Japan, South Korea, China.
Right.
In 1960, East Asia's GDP per worker was, I think, about 1/16 of the US level, just a tiny fraction.
And now.
By 2019, they'd climbed to almost a quarter, which might not sound huge, but you have to remember the US is growing that entire time, too. So to close the gap like that, it's an explosive amount of growth.
Lifted hundreds of millions out of poverty.
Absolutely. Then you have the second story, which is Europe.
And their story is a bit more stagnant.
In a way, after World War II, they were catching up fast, really converging with the US. But then around 1990, something happens. The line just flattens out.
So they stopped catching up.
They did. They're basically running parallel to the US now, keeping pace, but not closing that final gap.
And then there's the third story, the tragedy. Sub-Saharan Africa.
It's just heartbreaking data to look at. From 1960 to about 1980, the region was actually holding its own. It was growing alongside the US.
Okay, so they weren't falling behind.
Not initially, they were maintaining about a 1/8 ratio. But then the 80s and 90s hit and they just fell off a cliff. They dropped down to 1/16. They've stabilized a bit since, but that gap widened massively.
This brings up an idea I've always heard, this theory of convergence. The idea that poor countries should, naturally grow faster.
Unconditional convergence, yeah.
Right. Because it's easier to copy homework than to invent calculus from scratch. So why aren't they all catching up?
It's a beautiful theory that just isn't really supported by the data. There's no strong evidence that just being poor automatically makes you grow faster.
So there's no economic gravity pulling them up.
None. In fact, if you look at the data, rich countries are kind of boring. They all cluster around that 1.5 to 2% growth rate.
But developing countries.
They're all over the map. You get these incredible miracles like Singapore, but you also get complete collapses like Burundi or Venezuela. The defining feature isn't fast growth, it's volatility.
Okay, so if you need a ladder to climb, what's it made of? The source material breaks this down into three main ingredients, right? The whole
Yeah.
growth accounting idea.
Exactly. We try to explain that 64-fold gap by putting everything into three buckets. The first bucket is physical capital.
So machines, buildings, roads, computers, the actual stuff.
The stuff you can touch. Bucket two is human capital.
That's us. Our education, our skills.
Yeah. And then the third bucket is the mysterious one, TFP, or total factor productivity.
And I want to dig into this because I think for most people, the intuition is that wealth is about the stuff. It's about the physical capital.
Of course. You see a rich country, you see more cranes, better highways, bigger factories.
So you'd assume that explains most of the difference. But the data says no.
Not even close. The data is shocking. All that physical capital, the machines and infrastructure, it only explains about 14% of the Hendam difference between countries.
14, 1-4. It's almost nothing.
It's stunningly small. And human capital, so education and skills, that explains about 22%.
So hold on. Add those together and you're at, what, 36%? We're missing almost two-thirds of the explanation.
And welcome to the mystery of TFP, the residual, as they call it. It accounts for the other 64%.
Okay. The residual sounds like a very polite term for the stuff we can't explain.
The economist Moses Abramovitz famously called it the measure of our ignorance. But we have a better handle on it now.
So what is it?
It's efficiency. It's technology. It's not just about having tools. It's about how well you use them. It's the recipe, not just the ingredients.
Give me a real-world example of that.
Think about two kitchens. Both have the same exact ovens and knives. That's physical capital. Both have chefs with the same culinary degree, human capital.
Mm-hmm.
But one kitchen is chaos. Orders are lost. Food is burned. The other runs like a well-oiled machine.
And it produces twice as much food with the same ingredients.
Exactly. That difference. That's TFP. It's the organization, the process, the know-how. And that's what really separates rich from poor countries. It's not just that they have more computers. It's that they are organized in a way that extracts way more value from each computer.
And the sources say this is true for the U.S. itself over time. Our growth isn't just from piling up more stuff.
Not at all. About 3/4 of that steady 1.5% U.S. growth comes from TFP. It comes from getting smarter.
Like the IT boom in the 90s.
Perfect example. Companies didn't just buy computers. They completely reorganized their supply chains and their entire way of doing business around that new technology. The productivity came from the reorganization, not just the box on the desk.
Okay, but this feels like a bit of a chicken and egg problem. To be efficient with a tool, you still need the tool in the first place.
You do.
So why don't poor countries just buy the machines? I mean, if a tractor is the key, why is it so hard to get a tractor?
This is a fantastic question, and it leads to a really crucial idea in the source material about relative prices.
Relative to what?
Relative to the cost of everyday things, like food or a haircut. Here's the key finding. In the poorest countries, the price of investment goods, a tractor, a computer server, is roughly twice as high as it is in the U.S. relative to the price of consumption goods.
Whoa, okay. So if I'm a farmer in the U.S., I might have to sell, say, 100 bushels of wheat to buy a new plow.
Right. But a farmer in a very poor country might have to sell 200 or even 300 bushels of their crop to buy that exact same plow.
That's an incredible headwind. You're basically being taxed for trying to invest.
It's an inefficiency tax. It comes from bad infrastructure, unstable currencies, tariffs, a lack of skilled maintenance workers, 100 little things that add up.
So it's not that they don't want the tools. It's that the tools are astronomically expensive in their local terms.
Precisely. And that realization really changed economics. It moved the field away from older models where technology was just assumed to sort of fall from the sky for everyone.
To these new endogenous growth models.
Meaning growth from within. Growth is a choice. It's something you create through policy, through R&D, through innovation.
And the sources we looked at highlight two big ways this happens. The first is what they call the Romer model, about expanding varieties.
Paul Romer, yeah. His big insight was that we get richer not just by having more of the same stuff, but by having more options, more variety.
I feel this every time I go to the grocery store.
Right. But think about it for a business. A car mechanic with 5 different types of wrenches can do more and do it faster than a mechanic with just one. Expanding the toolkit makes labor more productive.
And the really powerful thing here is the nature of ideas themselves, this concept of non-rivalry.
This is the absolute core of it. Most goods are rival. If I drink this coffee, you can't.
But if you write a piece of software,
a million people can use it at the same time and it doesn't get used up. My using the blueprint for a new engine doesn't stop you from using it. Ideas can scale in a way physical objects just can't.
Okay, so that's one engine of growth, adding new things.
Yeah.
But the other one, the Schumpeterian model, feels a lot more brutal.
Joseph Schumpeter and his creative destruction.
Such a great name for an economic theory.
And it's so accurate. Rohmer is about adding new products. Schumpeter is about replacing the old with the new, better thing.
This is the quality ladder. The iPhone doesn't just sit next to the BlackBerry. It destroys the BlackBerry.
Netflix destroys Blockbuster. And this process is messy. It's turbulent. The data shows that in the U.S., over 10% of small firms die every single year.
Let's just think about the human cost of that. That's people's life savings gone. That's employees out of a job. It sounds incredibly painful.
It is undeniably painful for the people involved. But Schumpeter's point, and the data backs him up, is that this churn is the price of progress.
How so?
Well, the industries that have the highest exit rates, where inefficient firms are allowed to fail quickly, also tend to have the fastest productivity growth.
It's like economic natural selection. You have to clear out the old weak firms to make room for the new strong ones.
In a cold economic sense, yes. If you use policy to protect failing industries to save those jobs, you might accidentally be freezing the entire economy in place and stopping long-term growth for everyone.
This is where there's a worrying trend in the U.S. data, though, isn't there? This idea of business dynamism.
Yes. That churn, that creative destruction, seems to be slowing down. The share of workers in new, young startup firms has been falling for a couple of decades.
So we have less entry of new firms and less exit of old ones.
Right.
We're becoming more static.
That's the concern. The big incumbent firms are getting older and more dominant. If that engine of creative destruction starts to sputter, it could be a real threat to that 1.5% growth we've come to depend on.
Which brings us to this final, really provocative idea from the deep dive. The semi-endogenous problem, or the fishing out effect.
Right. The idea that all the easy ideas, they've been found.
The low-hanging fruit has been picked.
Think about it. 150 years ago, one person tinkering in a lab could invent the telephone. Today, to get a slightly better microchip, you need a team of thousands of PhDs and billions of dollars in equipment.
So the problems are getting harder.
Much harder. The data suggests we have to throw more and more researchers at problems just to keep the same rate of innovation going. We're running faster just to stay in the same place.
And if you need more and more brains to find the next idea, but global population growth is starting to slow down,
you might run out of innovators. You might run out of the raw material for growth, which is human ingenuity. And if that happens, that 1.5% line that looks so steady, it might not be a law of physics after all.
Well, on that slightly terrifying thought, it really changes how you see the world. Suddenly, a new app on your phone or a failed restaurant down the street, it's not just a random event.
It's the engine of growth working right in front of you. It's a reminder that prosperity isn't guaranteed. It's this messy, difficult, and constant process of building, destroying, and rebuilding.
A huge thank you for tuning in to this deep dive with us. We hope we've managed to boost your personal TFP just a little bit.
Keep thinking.